Chapter 21. Meant them to pull that boat. I represented to them with abject humility that I understood the management of a boat, and that, being three to pull, we could get a rest in turns. That decided them at last. It was time. A little more, and I would have gone into screaming fits at the drollness of it. At this point his excitement broke out. He jumped off the bench and gesticulated. The great shadows of his arms darting over roof and walls made the shed appear too small to contain his agitation. "I deny nothing," he burst out. I was elated, monsieur. I tasted a sort of felicity. But I kept very quiet. I took my turns at pulling all through the night. We made for the open sea, putting our trust in a passing ship. It was a foolhardy action. I persuaded them to it. When the sun rose, the immensity of water was calm, and the Isles de Salut appeared only like dark specks from the top of each swell. I was steering then. Maffle, who was pulling bow, let out an oath and said, "We must rest." The time to laugh had come at last. And I took my fill of it, I can tell you. I held my sides and rolled in my seat. They had such startled faces. "What's got into him, the animal?" cries Maffle. And Simon, who was nearest to me, says over his shoulder to him, "Devil take me, if I don't think he's gone mad." Then I produced the revolver. Aha! In a moment they both got the stoniest eyes you can imagine. Ha, ha! They were frightened. But they pulled. Oh, yes, they pulled all day, sometimes looking wild, and sometimes looking faint. I lost nothing of it, because I had to keep my eyes on them all the time, or else crack. They would have been on top of me in a second. I rested my revolver hand on my knee already, and steered with the other. Their faces began to blister. Sky and sea seemed on fire, round us, and the sea steamed in the sun. The boat made a sizzling sound as she went through the water. Sometimes Maffle foamed at the mouth and sometimes he groaned. But he pulled. He dared not stop. His eyes became bloodshot all over, and he had bitten his lower lip to pieces. Simon was as hoarse as a crow. "Comrade," he begins. "There are no comrades here. I am your patron." "Patron, then," he says, "in the name of humanity let us rest." I let them. There was a little rainwater washing about the bottom of the boat. I permitted them to snatch some of it in the hollow of their palms. But as I gave the command, "En route," I caught them exchanging significant glances. They thought I would have to go to sleep sometime. Aha! But I did not want to go to sleep. I was more awake than ever. It is they who went to sleep as they pulled, tumbling off the thwarts head over heels suddenly, one after another. I let them lie. All the stars were out. It was a quiet world. The sun rose. Another day. Alice. En route. They pulled badly. Their eyes rolled about and their tongues hung out. In the middle of the forenoon Maffle croaks out, "Let us make a rush at him, Simon. I would just as soon be shot at once, as to die of thirst, hunger, and fatigue at the oar." But while he spoke he pulled, and Simon kept on pulling too. It made me smile. Ah! They loved their life, these two, in this evil world of theirs, just as I used to love my life too, before they spoiled it for me with their phrases. I let them go on to the point of exhaustion, and only then I pointed at the sails of a ship on the horizon. Aha! You should have seen them revive, and buckle to their work. For I kept them at it to pull right across that ship's path. They were changed. The sort of pity I had felt for them left me. They looked more like themselves every minute. They looked at me with the glances I remembered so well. They were happy. They smiled. "Well," says Simon, "the energy of that youngster has saved our lives. If he hadn't made us, we could never have pulled so far out into the track of ships. Comrade, I forgive you. I admire you. apostrophe, and Maffle growls from forward. We owe you a famous debt of gratitude, comrade. You are cut out for a chief. Apostrophe, apostrophe, comrade. Monsieur. Ah, what a good word. And they, such men as these two, had made it accursed. I looked at them. I remembered their lies, their promises, their menaces, and all my days of misery. Why could they not have left me alone, after I came out of prison? I looked at them, and thought that, while they lived I could never be free. Never. Neither I nor others like me with warm hearts and weak heads. For I know I have not a strong head, monsieur. A black rage came upon me, the rage of extreme intoxication, but not against the injustice of society. Oh, no. I must be free. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I cried, furiously. Vive la liberté! Yells that ruffian Maffle. Mordaunt bourgeois who send us to Caen. They shall soon know that we are free. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the sky, the sea, the whole horizon, seemed to turn red, blood red all round the boat. My temples were beating so loud, that I wondered they did not hear. How is it, that they did not? How is it they did not understand? I heard Simon ask, have we not pulled far enough out now? Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes. Far enough, apostrophe, I said. I was sorry for him. It was the other I hated. He hauled in his oar with a loud sigh, and as he was raising his hand to wipe his forehead with the air of a man who has done his work, I pulled the trigger of my revolver and shot him like this off the knee, right through the heart. He tumbled down, with his head hanging over the side of the boat. I did not give him a second glance. The other cried out piercingly. Only one shriek of horror. Then all was still. He slipped off the thwart onto his knees, and raised his clasped hands before his face in an attitude of supplication. Mercy, apostrophe, he whispered, faintly. Mercy for me, comrade. Apostrophe, ah, comrade, apostrophe, I said, in a low tone. Yes, comrade, of course. Well then, shout vive l'anarchie. Apostrophe, he flung up his arms, his face up to the sky, and his mouth wide open in a great yell of despair. Vive l'anarchie! Vive apostrophe, he collapsed all in a heap, with a bullet through his head. I flung them both overboard. I threw away the revolver too. Then I sat down quietly. I was free at last. At last. I did not even look towards the ship. I did not care. Indeed, I think I must have gone to sleep, because all of a sudden there were shouts and I found the ship almost on top of me. They hauled me on board, and secured the boat astern. They were all blacks, except the captain, who was a mulatto. He alone knew a few words of French. I could not find out where they were going nor who they were. They gave me something to eat every day, but I did not like the way they used to discuss me in their language. Perhaps they were deliberating about throwing me overboard in order to keep possession of the boat. How do I know? As we were passing this island, I asked whether it was inhabited. I understood from the mulatto that there was a house on it. A farm, I fancied, they meant. So I asked them to put me ashore on the beach and keep the boat for their trouble. This, I imagine, was just what they wanted. The rest you know. After pronouncing these words, he lost suddenly all control over himself. He paced to and fro rapidly, till at last he broke into a run. His arms went like a windmill, and his ejaculations became very much like raving. The burden of them was that he need nothing, nothing. I could only let him go on, and sat out of his way, repeating, Calmus vos, Calmus vos, at intervals, till his agitation exhausted itself. I must confess too, that I remained there long, after he had crawled under his mosquito net. He had entreated me not to leave him, so, as one sits up with a nervous child, I sat up with him in the name of humanity till he fell asleep. On the whole, my idea is that he was much more of an anarchist than he confessed to me or to himself, and that, the special features of his case apart, he was very much like many other anarchists. Warm heart and weak head, that is the word of the riddle, And it is a fact that the bitterest contradictions and the deadliest conflicts of the world are carried on in every individual breast capable of feeling and passion. From personal inquiry, I can vouch that the story of the convict mutiny was in every particular as stated by him. When I got back to Horta from Cayenne and saw the anarchist again, he did not look well. He was more worn, still more frail, and very livid indeed under the grimy smudges of his calling. Evidently the meat of the company's main herd, in its unconcentrated form, did not agree with him at all. It was on the pontoon in Horta that we met, and I tried to induce him to leave the launch moored where she was, and follow me to Europe there and then. It would have been delightful to think of the excellent manager's surprise and disgust at the poor fellow's escape. But he refused with unconquerable obstinacy. "Surely you don't mean to live always here," I cried. He shook his head. "I shall die here," he said. Then added moodily, "away from them." Sometimes I think of him lying open-eyed on his horseman's gear in the low shed full of tools and scraps of iron, the anarchist slave of the Marinan estate, waiting with resignation for that sleep which let from him, as he used to say, in such an unaccountable manner. A military tale, the duel, Napoleon, whose career had the quality of a duel against the whole of Europe, disliked dueling between the officers of his army. The great military emperor was not a swashbuckler, and had little respect for tradition. Nevertheless, a story of dueling, which became a legend in the army, runs through the epic of imperial wars. To the surprise and admiration of their fellows, two officers, like insane artists trying to gild refined gold or paint the lily, pursued a private contest through the years of universal carnage. They were officers of cavalry, and their connection with the high-spirited, but fanciful animal which carries men into battle seems particularly appropriate. It would be difficult to imagine for heroes of this legend two officers of infantry of the line, for example, whose fantasy is tamed by much walking exercise, and whose valor necessarily must be of a more plodding kind. As to gunners or engineers, whose heads are kept cool on a diet of mathematics, it is simply unthinkable. The names of the two officers were Ferron and Dubert, and they were both lieutenants in a regiment of hussars, but not in the same regiment. Ferron was doing regimental work, but lieut. Dubert had the good fortune to be attached to the person of the general commanding the division, as officier d'ordnance. It was in Strasbourg, and in this agreeable and important garrison they were enjoying greatly a short interval of peace. They were enjoying it, though both intensely warlike, because it was a sword-sharpening, firelock-cleaning peace, dear to a military heart and undamaging to military prestige, inasmuch that no one believed in its sincerity or duration. Under those historical circumstances, so favorable to the proper appreciation of military leisure, Lieut. Dubert, one fine afternoon, made his way along a quiet street of a cheerful suburb towards Lieut. Ferron's quarters, which were in a private house with a garden at the back, belonging to an old maiden lady. His knock at the door was answered instantly by a young maid in Alsatian costume. Her fresh complexion and her long eyelashes, lowered demurely at the sight of the tall officer, caused Lieut. Dubert, who was accessible to aesthetic impressions, to relax the cold, severe gravity of his face. At the same time he observed that the girl had over her arm a pair of hussar's breeches, blue with a red stripe. "Lieut. Ferron in?" he inquired, benevolently. "Oh, no, sir. He went out at 6 this morning." The pretty maid tried to close the door. "Lieut. Dubert," opposing this move with gentle firmness. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.